Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a huge hurricane bearing down on the Carolinas and analyze why increasingly destructive and costly floods, fires, droughts, and hurricanes are happening with more frequency and intensity as extreme weather becomes the new normal. Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy, joins us. We will discuss the disconnect between the reality facing us and the planet and the policies of the Trump administration, which go beyond denial to outright hostility to the modest efforts so far to deal with the worsening climate crisis. As global warming makes the Atlantic Ocean warmer, hurricanes are moving north from their usual trajectory of hitting the Caribbean to striking population centers on America's East Coast, meaning it will be only a matter of time before New York City is directly impacted by a superstorm. Meanwhile, Trump and his cabinet in the pocket of the oil and gas lobby are making it easier for oil and gas companies to pollute with impunity by releasing methane, a virulent global warming gas, 100 times worse than CO2. Then we'll get an update on the censure vote today in the European Parliament to punish Hungary's leader, Viktor Orbán, for breaches of the core values of the European Union, and speak with our Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies at Rutgers University. He joins us to discuss whether the EU rule Article 7 could be triggered to suspend Hungary from the 28-member EU, which is unlikely because Poland is likely to veto such a move. Then finally, we'll examine what might be going on in terms of some kind of budding relationship between Russia and China as the country's two leaders met today in Vladivostok and made pancakes together on the waterfront at Russia's Pacific port. As a major military exercise involving 300,000 troops, 36,000 tanks, and 1,000 aircraft got underway, with Chinese troops drilling with Russian service members in the Vostok 2018 war games. Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University who specializes in Russian and Chinese relations, joins us to assess whether these historical rivals are becoming allies. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And his latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And frankly, as you probably know, President Trump drives a lot of people crazy, me included. But his latest move now to let the oil and gas people essentially vent or leak methane into the air with impunity is just so appalling. It's got the California governor tearing his hair out, not that Jerry Brown has much hair left, but still. I mean, here we have a situation where extreme weather is becoming the new normal, and this huge hurricane's bearing down in the Carolinas. And what is our president doing? He's encouraging the worst greenhouse-producing gas to be let off into the atmosphere. I don't know what the figures are, but I understand methane is something like 100 times worse than CO2.
On a 20-year time scale, if you're looking at the next couple decades, then methane, sort of, you know, pound for pound, is nearly 100 times as potent as greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide. Now, it exists in much lower concentrations, so it's still a secondary player relative to the carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning, but still, it aggravates the problem. And as you allude to, you know, I would say it was tone deaf, except for the fact that, of course, you could argue that everything that this president does seem to be tone deaf. It seems to ignore public opinion. It seems to ignore, you know, basic common sense. At the very time that we are We have witnessed an unprecedented summer of extreme weather destruction, and now, obviously, the California wildfires, and now as we get into the fall, we are seeing an historic hurricane about to strike what may be the highest latitude that a Category 4, if it remains a Category 4 storm, has ever reached, a landfalling Category 4 storm. And these storms are getting stronger because of warming ocean temperatures. So, yeah, on the very day that we're preparing for this, we would call it a natural disaster, except that it has been made more of a disaster by human-caused climate change. And at that very moment, of course, Trump is doing everything he can now to basically revoke every bit of progress that we've made in tackling this problem here in the United States in the past several decades.
Well, I don't think it's that he's clueless. I think he's a very simple guy. If you criticize him and don't support him, he hates you, and he'll say the worst things about you and demean and belittle you. But if you flatter him, he'll love you because he essentially loves himself. So it's pretty easy. If you're in the oil and gas business, if you're a fracker, then you just give him some money and tell him how great he is, and he'll do anything you want. It's almost like he's deliberately in our face just saying, screw you and screw the planet.
Yeah, I think there does seem to be an aspect of that to his behavior, doesn't there? But moreover, I think that when it comes to energy and climate policy in particular, this is really, an area of his presidency where I think he has ultimately delegated responsibility to the fossil fuel lobbyists who run his cabinet. He, in essence, is simply doing the bidding of the fossil fuel interests that helped get him elected. And I think there was sort of an unholy alliance that was reached at some point where they said, Trump, we'll let you be you, but you've got to let us appoint the people that we want in your cabinet to make sure that we get the sort of fossil fuel-friendly policies that we want. And I'm talking about the Koch brothers and fossil fuel interests. And so I do think there was an unholy alliance that was formed. And when it comes to energy and climate policy, he's basically, outsourced his policies to the fossil fuel industry and to the big polluters like the Koch brothers.
But the two people who seem to have the most influence over Trump, and certainly without Putin, it's very likely that Trump may not have even been elected. And without Rupert Murdoch, he wouldn't have been elected, and he wouldn't maintain his base, because it's Rupert Murdoch that's maintaining this 30%, whatever it is, of the base that believes everything that Trump says and thinks everything else is fake news. And they're absolutely locked in this bubble of delusion that's impermeable. There's no way that facts and evidence can reach them. So if you think for a second, Rupert Murdoch, the second biggest investor in News Corp after the family, Murdoch family, is the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia. And Putin, his entire economy in Russia depends upon extracting oil and gas. And if all of Russia's oil and gas were to be burned up, the planet would be fried.
Yeah, no, that's right. What was it, a $500 billion oil deal between Rosneft, the Russian fossil fuel company Rosneft, and ExxonMobil, that had basically been stymied by sanctions against Russia. And, of course, the first thing that the Trump administration tried to do, in fact, even at the during the Republican convention, they changed the party platform to try to eliminate those sanctions so that ExxonMobil and Russia could engage in this joint venture to mine $500 billion worth of fossil fuels. So I don't think we can neglect that. I think, in fact, it's possible that when we look back at everything that's happened and the sort of Russian interference with our election and Trump's apparent complicity with that, when we look back, ultimately, I think we're going to see that the agenda of fossil fuel interests played a central role in all of this.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founding contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And his books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And his latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. So given how much damage the fires here in California did, and the firefighting fund is absolutely empty, the treasury's empty because of these fires, and they're continuing. And then you've got the possibility of massive damage in the Carolinas when Florence makes landfall, which I believe is tomorrow evening. So at what point do, if you got ExxonMobil on the one side wanting to just make money and keep people in the bubble of denial about climate change, and at the same time advertise how much they care about the environment and how much they are backing alternative energy, which they're not doing, but they say they're doing. Yeah. That's their agenda is pretty manifestly clear. But what about the insurance companies? They're a pretty powerful bunch. They're going to lose their shirts, aren't they?
They are, and even more importantly, the reinsurance industry, those who insure the insurers. And so you're right. In a sense, this is shaping up to be a battle between two, you know, economic titans. On the one hand, you have the fossil fuel industry. On the other hand, you have the reinsurance industry. And increasingly, you know, there, even when you look at the energy industry, the more enlightened energy companies are, in fact, moving away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. They see that that's where, you know, the world is headed. And those who get on board, you know, earliest are ultimately going to win out in this economic battle over the next century. The age of fossil fuels is ending. Now, there's some who are trying to drag it out, drag their heels to retrench. There are fossil fuel interests like ExxonMobil who are doing everything they can to sort of slow down that transition, at least in the U.S., through the stranglehold that they currently have on our politics. But the rest of the world is moving, moving ahead, and ultimately it's simply a question of whether the U.S. is going to be left behind economically as we do make this transition. We will make this transition. Now, the question is how much damage can they do in the meantime by delaying this transition and ensuring additional planetary warming and all of the impacts that come with it? You know, as you summarized, the costs that California is bearing and what we're about to see happen on the East Coast, and of course Harvey last year, and the devastation of Puerto Rico, by any reasonable measure, the cost of inaction is already so much greater than the cost of taking action. And so from an economic standpoint, the only thing that makes sense is to move away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, we have a few bad players, powerful vested interests, who are trying, you know, going to do everything they can to slow down that transition. I mean, with every year of, you know, inaction on climate, ExxonMobil continues to make, you know, record profits. And so they're going to drag this out as long as they possibly can.
So even though people in the Fox bubble are immune to facts and evidence, I think it's still worth talking to our audience, Michael Mann, about what is actually happening here and what the relationship between global warming and these extreme weather events like this huge hurricane Florence approaching the Carolinas. You mentioned a minute ago about how it's to do with global warming, warming the ocean waters, and that means that the ocean is warmer going north up the coast than it's ever been before. This is the most northerly Category 4 hurricane on record, which would indicate if we're on that trajectory, it won't be long before these massive hurricanes will be directly impacting some of the biggest population centers like New York.
No, that's right. And in fact, that seems to be a pretty robust prediction now. There are a number of different modeling groups that have now all come to the same conclusion that one of the impacts of climate change will be to change prevailing wind patterns such that these storms start to take a more northerly track, and storms that, you know, not that it's it's good to see major landfalling hurricanes impact the Caribbean and the islands, but we are going to see some of the major population centers along the U.S. East Coast become more vulnerable. And, you know, again, here, you know, and in many of these cases, as you alluded to, the science, the underlying science, it's not rocket science, okay? You warm up the oceans, well, it's the ocean heat that powers these storms, that intensifies these storms. So you warm up the oceans, you provide more fuel to power these storms, and you get more of these Category 4, Category 5 monster storms. And it's not a coincidence that over the past few years, when the world's oceans have been at their warmest, we have seen the strongest storm ever globally in Patricia in the Pacific 2 years ago, Winston in the Southern Hemisphere, strongest storm globally, strongest storm in both hemispheres, strongest storm in the Pacific, and with Irma last year, the strongest storm in the open Atlantic. It's not a coincidence. It's not rocket science. Warming is giving us more intense and destructive hurricanes and typhoons and super typhoons and super storms. Let's talk about the wildfires in California this last summer, because those, that extreme weather doesn't stand in isolation. We had this extreme heat and continuing drought and wildfires as a result in California, but we also had a heat wave and wildfires in the Arctic. We had record-setting heat in over large parts of Europe and unprecedented flooding in Japan. When you look at all of these events collectively, there are several things going on here, each of which relate to climate change. Okay, you warm up the planet, you're going to get longer-lasting and more intense heat waves. That's obvious. But when you warm up the atmosphere, it can hold more moisture, so there's the potential for greater amounts of rainfall in short periods of time. And indeed, last year with Harvey, we saw the worst flooding event on record in the United States. Well, you also evaporate moisture from soils more rapidly, and that gives you the unprecedented drought that California has seen and droughts elsewhere around the world, including Australia, Southern Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere. Okay, so more heat, more drought, well, that gives you more wildfires, and you've got these more extreme flooding events. That's all really basic science, but that doesn't explain the whole picture, because when you look around the Northern Hemisphere, it isn't a coincidence that we had all of these unprecedented weather events playing out at the same time in late July, early August. Record floods, droughts, heat waves, and wildfires. It wasn't just the factors that I mentioned before, which are all well understood and which all imply that we see more of these weather extremes. It's also the fact that the jet stream itself is changing. It's changing in a way that allows these weather systems essentially to get stuck. You get more persistent weather so that the same location gets rained on day after day after day, and that's when you get unprecedented flooding. Or the same location gets baked day after day, and that's when you get unprecedented heat and drought and wildfire like we saw in California. And that appears to relate to a slowing down of the jet stream and sort of an increase in the wiggling pattern of the jet stream that gives you more of those extremes. So you get more of those extremes, and they sit in the same place day after day after day. That's what gives you truly unprecedented extreme weather events. And that was playing out. And we know that climate change had a role there as well. Now, here's an important point. That situation, the sort of dynamics that I just described, are actually not well captured by current generation climate models. So, yeah, there are uncertainties in the models. They're not perfect, but they're probably under-predicting the impact that climate change is having on these extreme weather events, because they're not properly capturing this effect that climate change appears to be having on the jet stream, giving us those very persistent extreme weather patterns that we saw this summer. There is uncertainty in the science, but uncertainty is not our friend. If anything, we're seeing worse impacts than we expected at this point, and our models, in many respects, underpredicted the sort of extent of impacts that we're already seeing.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned the unprecedented drought in Australia, But the extraordinary thing is that they're having their Trump moment with the ruling Conservative Party called the Liberals.
That's right.
And they booted out the former Prime Minister Turnbull, who actually wanted to do something about global warming.
He wasn't great either.
He wasn't. No, he was a real compromiser and a bit of a wuss.
Yeah.
But he's not anti-intellectual. He's not a boneheaded reactionary like the people that have taken over now. And they've actually got an evangelical as the prime minister. And you know how crazy the evangelicals are. They have no sense of God's gift, this planet. For the life of me, I don't understand their...
Some do. More enlightened evangelicals. And my colleague, Catherine Hayhoe, who's an evangelical Christian and a climate scientist, is wonderful on this issue. But you're right. Too many have sort of disregarded what the Bible actually does preach on this.
Right. The point I wanted to get to is, how do you deal with... I brought up Australia because it's such a glaring example of a country being ravaged by climate change, and yet its politics are going in the opposite direction. And we started out this conversation by pointing out in this country the politics are going in the opposite direction. We have a president who is enabling the oil and gas companies to create more CO2 and methane in order to destroy the climate and accelerate global warming. And yet the evidence should be manifestly clear to all.
Yeah, you know, I've spent some time in Australia. My sense is the people get it. They're actually further along than the electorate is here in the United States. And so, while you're right, there are these backward policies now with this new administration. The people don't seem to be happy with that. And so I actually think that we will ultimately see those policies not take. I don't think that this administration is going to be successful in implementing these policies. I think there's going to be enough pushback. But we'll have to see how that plays out in the months ahead. And certainly, you know, it's not where we'd like things to be. You know, at a time when Australia appeared to be moving Canada appeared to be moving forward, we've seen some retrenchment, among countries that had seemed committed to climate action, had seemed committed to meeting their obligations under the Paris Climate Treaty. So obviously, you know, this is not where we'd like to be, and it's going to require people, you know, pushing back and speaking out. And in here in the United States, as you know, there's an opportunity to do that in about 60 days. People have an opportunity to show up at the polls and make their voices heard and send a strong message that they do not support the inaction by the Trump administration and complicit congressional Republicans when it comes to climate change. And ideally, we will see the voters come out and support candidates who want to act on climate and boot candidates who won't.
Well, on that note, I hope from your lips to God's ears, and I thank you for joining us.
Michael, thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And his books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And his latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving us crazy. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking about the vote in the European Parliament today to censure Hungary's Viktor Orban.
If it keeps on raining, that is going to break. If it keeps on raining, that is going to break. When the levee breaks, have no place to stay.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is R. Daniel Kellerman, who is the Jean Monnet Chair and the Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policies in the EU and Beyond. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and Western European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kellerman.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, Daniel, what did you make of the vote today in the European Parliament to censure Hungary's Viktor Orbán? Obviously, if they were to suspend the Hungary's voting rights under Article 7 of the EU Charter, then probably Poland would veto that. So is there any substance behind what happened today?
Well, I don't think it's going to end up in sanctions or suspension of voting rights through this Article 7 procedure, which you mentioned. Nevertheless, I think it's a real landmark day for the EU, for the European Parliament, because this is really the first time that the European Parliament or the EU collectively has taken a stand to say the developments in Hungary, the government's efforts to dismantle democracy and replace it really with a form of kind of competitive or soft authoritarianism is unacceptable and violates European values. So this is, you know, a beginning step of standing up to Orbán. It's important for that reason.
But it seemed to be sort of split along political rather than national lines, if you will, although the whole point of the EU is to get rid of nationalism. And I think that's a huge success, which is not often lauded and appreciated. But my sense is that, you know, when you have the Greens and the Social Democrats across the board in various countries voting to censure Orbán, and then you've got the right-wingers and the far-right-wingers and the Brexit people Farage and new sort of neo-fascists in Italy and in Austria doing the same. Is that how the vote broke down?
Okay, well, so it's an excellent question because it really is an issue of party politics, which a lot of people don't realize that there is party politics at the EU level in the European Parliament, where you have these party groups or Euro parties that pool together. As you said, whether it's Christian Democrats or socialists or Greens or far-right parties, there's a number of these groups that pool together that family of parties from many different countries, right? And then they vote together, act together at the European level. And the background, really, if you ask yourself, why is it that the EU has done so little as Hungary has really, you've seen this erosion of democracy and respect for the rule of law, et cetera. The key reason was that Viktor Orban's party, Fidesz, was always a member of the very powerful, the most powerful party at the EU level called the European People's Party, which is in fact the center-right party of which, for instance, Merkel's Christian Democrats are also a member, right? And so you had this dynamic of party politics where that European People's Party kept protecting Orban's government and shielding them against any censure or kind of sanctions from the EU. So in the past, when there were moves to try to, you know, do something, take votes about action about Hungary, that powerful party of Orbán's always defended him and blocked action. And so today was a huge turning point because, you know, for the first time, and this happened, it was announced last night that some of the leaders of the European People's Party, after a meeting with Orbán, sort of said, well, now enough is enough. You know, we're not going to put partisan interest above democratic principle this time. At least, you know, that's how they're framing it. And saying we're going to support this action, this vote of censure against Orbán's government and call for, you know, them to be held to account. And so that was key. The key thing was that the center-right, at least most of it, not all, but a majority of the center-right, finally turned against Orbán, joining up with other parties like on the center-left or left that were already criticizing him. And so, yeah, the only defenders he had left were a few from the center-right, like Berlusconi's Forza Italia party, mostly supported Orban, and then parties from further to the right, parties like UKIP in the UK or National Front in France, those. And then, quite disappointingly, also the British Conservatives, right, voted in support of Orban, most of them. There were a few who broke with their party and, you know, criticized him, but most defended him.
So how's this playing, though, in Hungary? Is he able to be the odd man out, the guy that's standing up to all those bureaucrats in Brussels?
I don't really buy that line of argument. You know, some people even have said, well, they shouldn't try to sanction him because he'll just turn it around and play the victim and make the EU the enemy and it'll play into his hands somehow. But he does that anyway. He's been running kind of mass campaigns with billboards around the country, a series of these over the years, blaming Brussels for things anyway and attacking Brussels. So, you know, he constantly bashes the EU in any case, even when they were taking no action against him, you know, just treating them as a kind of enemy. So he's going to do that regardless. And, you know, the fact remains that EU membership, you know, despite his propaganda machine control of most of the media in Hungary, et cetera, and all this EU bashing, EU membership in the EU remains very popular with Hungarian citizens, right? So, you know, I don't think, you know, he's succeeding in demonizing the EU with the populace the way he might want to.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Kellerman, who is the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union and the Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policy in the EU and Beyond. And he serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. And you wrote an article with Kim Lane Shapil about essentially, I'm astounded. I mean, I know that back in April, The Economist had an article titled "The EU is Tolerating and Enabling an Authoritarian Kleptocracy in Hungary." But what you and Kim are arguing is that, you know, we talked earlier about the somewhat futile idea of suspending their voting rights, Hungary's voting rights, which would be automatically vetoed by Poland. But the EU is in this perverse situation, I'm reading from your article, of providing some of the largest transfers of funds precisely to those governments who most prominently thumb their noses at its democratic and rule of law norms. Within the EU, both Hungary and Poland are huge beneficiaries of EU fiscal transfers. Poland is the largest overall recipient, taking in 86 billion euros from various European structural investment funds. So that's pretty surreal, isn't it? I mean, why can't they?
Oh, yeah, look, the situation is ridiculous, right? They're subsidizing these governments who attack their core norms, defy them, and denounce, you know, the EU all the time. So it's a ridiculous situation. And, you know, sorry, I think I interrupted you. I think you were asking, you know, why can't they do something about this? And I think, you know, the argument you often hear is, oh, we just lack the tools, right? And we don't have the right legal instruments or the right ways to, you know, apply pressure on these governments. And then it's often pointed to, you know, the main sanction mechanism, this Article 7, which would require unanimous agreement of the other governments before any sanctions could be applied. And then they say, well, we can't get unanimity because some of these governments will protect each other, like Poland and Hungary. So then, you know, throw our hands in the air, can't do anything. What we argue there is, no, that's wrong. The EU does have tools if it would just have the political will to apply them. Now, why doesn't it have political will? I think it has historically gone back to what I mentioned before, the party politics, right? That Orban had a lot of powerful allies through this European People's Party, both in the parliament, but also in the commission, right? And so he was shielded, right? But with that breaking down, that kind of alliance, and he might even, I hope he'll be thrown out of the European People's Party, and we'll see if that happens. That hasn't happened yet. But if that alliance breaks down, you know, and he doesn't enjoy that political protection, then the question is, okay, what tools are there? And we argue in that paper that they could, in fact, under current regulations, even without, there's a lot of talk about maybe passing new procedures to make funding conditional on better respect for rule of law, et cetera. But what we say is they don't need to pass any new rules, because if you just look at the current regulations of all these EU funding mechanisms, it says in there, essentially, that funds to a country could be suspended if the government, temporarily at least, if the government doesn't have in place the appropriate oversight and control mechanisms, you know, to assure the proper spending of the funds, essentially, right? Well, if you have a government that has basically had a party political capture of the judiciary, where you don't really have an independent judiciary anymore, then sort of by definition, you don't have the necessary control mechanisms to oversee the spending of the money. So what we're saying is they should just declare, right, that the rule of law has been too compromised in these countries, and so the flow of funds must be suspended until the rule of law is restored.
Right, but you were saying earlier, Daniel Kellerman, that the Hungarian people like the EU. They like being in the EU, and I imagine one of the main reasons they like being in the EU is they get a lot of money from them. So wouldn't pulling the plug on the gravy train, wouldn't that get the people's attention? Because at the end of the day, the only way to get rid of Orban is for the Hungarian people to boot him out.
Well, look, and of course, if they suspend funds, of course, Orban is, or if they do this with Poland, you know, the peace government in Poland will say the same thing. They'll bash the EU. They'll say this is the EU's fault, et cetera, and there'll be a kind of propaganda war, essentially. And it'll be the EU's job to just make clear, we're just suspending the funds until your government, you know, restores the independence of the judiciary and the needed control of corruption, et cetera. And then, you know, we would like to the funds to keep going. We don't want to, you know, we don't want individual citizens to suffer, right? We don't want worthy projects not to get funded, but we, you know, can't continue to pour money into a kind of legal black hole where there isn't accountability.
But is the European Parliament or whoever would speak for them capable of that kind of clarity?
That's a great question, and I guess I would just say we don't know till we try, right? Because clearly whatever the EU's been doing so far hasn't been working. A lot of people have said, oh, let's just continue dialogue. You know, if we crack down too hard, then there'll be a backlash or the people will side with their governments, et cetera. But all that talk, all that we've seen is that this approach of ongoing dialogue or, you know, just avoiding any kind of sanctions hasn't worked at all. Instead, both in Hungary, we've seen this, you know, continual slide deeper and deeper into more authoritarian practices, a tighter concentration of power, et cetera. And then in Poland, they said, well, if Hungary can get away with this, you know, when the peace government in Poland came into power in 2015, they said, well, we'll do the same thing too. And they're pushing ahead very fast to do the same thing. So I think it's like, you know, very often in politics, you get this kind of argument where, if you try to do something, it will be futile or it might backfire, et cetera. But that often just, to me, is an excuse for inaction and doing nothing, which doesn't work.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I mean, it's extraordinary that this motley crew of lowlifes like Nigel Farage, Stephen Bannon, Salvini, Austrian power behind the scenes, Strache, they're just horrible people. Orban, of course, himself. And what is their fascination with Putin? What is that all about?
Oh, with Putin. Well, I mean, that's a big story. But I would say, you know, in some cases, there are very, you know, close, you know, ties, direct ties between the individuals or the parties you mentioned and the government, you know, and the Putin government and his United Russia party. So, you know, the Freedom Party in Austria, you were mentioning, they have a kind of alliance therein, some kind of international association therein with Putin's party, right? You know, famously, a foreign minister who's affiliated with them. Putin just went to her wedding, right? And as the guest of honor, things like that. Farage was a regular guest on Russia Today. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about the Russian role in, and you've seen reports in The Guardian and other places recently about Russian role in the Brexit referendum, both potentially in, you know, financing it via Aaron Banks and others. There's allegations about that, and then also about the manipulation through social media, et cetera, to try to affect the result. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think that the unifying factor, if you step away from all those specific stories, is that one of Putin's crucial strategic goals is to divide Europe, and if he could, to kind of destroy the European Union, but certainly to make it weak and divided. And one of the key ways he does that, right, is to support these anti-EU, Eurosceptic, and far-right parties who you know, then can be forces against the EU from within and help divide Europe, right? So that's what they all have in common, is that, you know, they're supported by and share some common ideological goals with Putin.
Well, Daniel Kellerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with R. Daniel Kellerman, who's a Jean Monnet Chair and the Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and the Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policies in the EU and Beyond. And he serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether China and Russia are becoming allies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, who specializes in the societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. The editor of the ASEAN Forum, he's the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations and North Korea and Mongolia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Rosman.
I'm glad to join you.
Well, thank you, Gilbert. What do you make of the meeting today in Vladivostok between Russia's President Putin and China's leader Xi Jinping? They made pancakes together on the waterfront at the harbor in the Pacific port of Vladivostok. At the same time, of course, this massive exercise is underway with 300,000 troops involved, both Chinese and Russian, 36,000 tanks and 1,000 aircraft. So these are traditional historical rivals, I guess you'd say. But are they becoming allies?
Well, this meeting was much bigger than that. Prime Minister Abe of Japan was there. The Prime Minister of Korea was there, and not the president. This was the Eastern Economic Forum, which Putin convenes once every year. But this is the first time that President Xi Jinping has come from China, and that was indicative of the further upgrading of Sino-Russian relations. Are they becoming allies? Well, I wouldn't put it that strongly, but I think they've been quasi-allies for a number of years, and their relationship is getting stronger.
So there was just another summit meeting with all of the important players in what's happening in Syria at the moment. And, you know, that's a huge flashpoint, and there could be another massive humanitarian catastrophe as the last pocket of resistance is destroyed and 3 million refugees maybe, you know, will pour into Europe. That struck me that, you know, where's the American government? And now you have a similar situation, not that the U.S. has ever been to one of these forums before, but still it feels to me like maybe a lot of these countries, China, Japan, Russia, and in the case of the Middle East, Turkey, Iran, Russia, Syria, etc., they're all getting together because the U.S. has such a vacuum in its leadership.
Well, it's true that there are a lot of tensions between the United States and even its allies, as well as worse relationship with Russia and China than has been present for a very long time. So that creates an atmosphere that could be used for China to try to fill the vacuum and strengthen ties with Russia. But this meeting, these meetings with Putin in Vladivostok, are oversold. I mean, Putin claims huge successes, and a lot of these efforts are really covering up problems that still exist. Right now, Russian and Chinese economic problems are more serious than they've been. Right now, Putin said to Abe, I want to get a deal by the end of the year to solve our long-running territorial dispute. But he didn't make any concessions on the one thing that matters most to the Japanese, to prepare some kind of joint development. They want some change in the approach to sovereignty, so they're not just joining Russia and confirming Russian sovereignty. And that's the sort of thing that's going on. They're claiming wonderful things are happening at this meeting, but it's less than what they indicate, and that goes for Sino-Russian relations too.
So is Putin playing to his domestic audience? Is that what's going on then, where he makes this big deal? We're going to finally settle our territorial dispute with Japan that's been festering since World War II, and makes an offer that is nothing what the Japanese can't even entertain. What's he doing in terms of sort of, you know, flim-flam, if you will, with China? Because I would have thought that there's a natural deal in the making there. If the Russians can pipe their natural gas and oil into China and to Korea, wouldn't that save China a lot of money, not having to ship it all the way from Iran and other Gulf?
Well, these pipelines are very long, and so it's not a big question of saving money, because liquid natural gas shipped around the world by sea is not more expensive than these really expensive pipeline developments. The big pipeline, Power of Siberia, is supposed to open in about 1 year. That's the big Russia-China pipeline that they've been discussing and working on for 5 years. They also have an idea where they're now trying to develop their economic ties without using the dollar, using their own currencies much more. So there are a number of things going on between China and Russia that indicate some stronger relations. But it's not likely that Chinese are going to invest heavily in Russia. They haven't in the past. And these big projects that they keep talking about, like a big railroad, long-distance railroad, are just too expensive given the difficulties that both countries are facing right now. So they will indicate that they have this wonderful relationship, and in some ways they will strengthen ties, as indicated by the military exercises they're carrying on together. And, of course, the weak U.S. relations with both of those countries make them more eager to do so. But I don't think that there's any kind of game changer right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Gilbert Rosman, who's professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in the societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia, the editor of the ASEAN Forum. He's the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations and North Korea and Mongolia. So in terms of their historic rivalry, there was during the Soviet Union, the days of the Soviet Union, there were some fairly tense moments. There was even there was even discussions, I believe, between the Nixon administration, or at least feelers were sent from Brezhnev to the Nixon administration, maybe that the Americans should turn a blind eye when the when the Russians nuke Lop Nor, which was the Chinese nuclear test site before they went nuclear. But my sense, if you just look at the map, is China is a heavily populated country where its land and water resources have been very mismanaged and polluted. And then you've got the Russian Pacific East, which is very thinly populated and vast, vast amounts of empty forest. So can that last forever? I mean, isn't there a possibility at some point or other that the Chinese will start moving into that territory? Or is that a simplistic notion on my part?
This was a theme 25 years ago, and it's been pretty well handled. Right now, Chinese make more money than the Russians in that part of the Far East, so they're not so eager to go work there anymore. The migration has slowed down a lot. Besides, there were a lot of strict controls on it. Russia has a huge labor shortage. I don't think China is now beginning to have a labor shortage. There aren't very many Chinese eager to go off to the Russian Far East, and the laws there and the conditions there are just very, very inadequate for the Chinese. They haven't been treated so well there. So I don't think that is the big issue anymore. I do think, though, that Russia wants to develop its Far East. Putin, by going out to Vladivostok each year and inviting the leaders of the region, he even wanted Kim Jong-un to come. And he wanted this to be this huge gathering of the business and political leaders in the East Asia, all coming to join him, and he got some response, but not that great. But he wants to build up the Russian Far East as something spectacular. And one thing he wants to build is the Northern Sea Route, and get Chinese cooperation in sending goods from China, not by sea through the Suez Canal, but by sea around the northern part of Russia on the Arctic Sea, and that could save as many as 7 days. And they're waiting for global warming to help keep melting the ice, as has been happening. So this is just one more way that China and Russia need each other, but right now it's still a long way off before they can make profitable use of this sea route. And in other respects, they talk a good game, but they don't really accomplish very much together. Many of the Chinese projects that Russia has wanted have not materialized.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much of Chinese labor going into Russia's Far East, because they use now, the Russians use cheap North Korean labor. But just
not very much, no. They only have about 30,000-40,000 North Koreans
who
work as construction laborers and loggers, not much.
Right, but my sense is that you've got this overcrowded territory, and then right next door you've got this sparse territory with all of these resources. You don't think at any point the Chinese are just going to expand and fill the vacuum?
Well, if the resources, the Chinese can invest as much as they want.
Right.
I mean, the Russians want to sell them resources, and the Chinese are buying some of them. So there's no need to take over the territory for that purpose.
I see.
And in fact, a lot of these resources are very expensive to bring out, and China's trying to become less resource intense right now. There is a surplus in some of the things that they would want. So I don't think the Chinese have any particular need in the near future, at least. If they want to take over some of the territory because they have historical grievances and say, oh, this was ours 150 years ago, that might come at some future point. But right now, they are cooperating very nicely with Russia, and they've resolved the territory disputes that they used to have. They've signed agreements, and both sides say these are good deals.
Well, I was thinking in terms of going back to Nixon's initiative with Mao, where Nixon put the United States in the catbird seat, where they're able to play off China against Russia and vice versa. Is there any triangulation going on here, either from Putin's point of view or from Xi's point of view?
I think they both still think that the U.S. is the problem, it's a problem because of they're going back to identities that make it the U.S. much more of an enemy, and a sort of an ideological enemy, an enemy in a lot of other ways, to what they're trying to do. They want to create a different order. And I don't see either side moving towards trying to become the middle of, in this relationship and striking better relations with the United States. Nor is the United States, despite some debate, likely to say, oh, we can work with, closer with Russia, and that will strengthen our position to China, or work more with China versus Russia. The people who suggest that's going to happen in this so-called strategic triangle have just been wrong over the last 20 years. It's just not happening.
So what is happening?
Russia and China are committing themselves more strongly to try to establish some kind of Eurasian framework that where they can work together and try to exclude the U.S. more and more. North Korea is one of the big issues for them. They're trying to get an outcome on the Korean Peninsula that will drive the United States away. They're trying to create an atmosphere in much of Asia where the U.S. position is weakened and U.S. alliances are weakened. So that they're working together, and they're developing a sense of identity together, blaming the United States. And it's become easier to do so because the Trump administration is so unpopular and has alienated so many others.
Well, it makes you realize how Trump has been such an asset or help to both Putin and Xi. One of the first things he did, of course, was to get out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That's right. That was something both of them wanted very much. But on the other hand, right now, his administration is intensifying sanctions against Russia. No matter what Trump says about Putin, Russia and the U.S. relations are going downhill. And with China, this is a nightmare for China. These trade problems.
Right. A possible trade war, right, yeah.
Right. So they're not at all satisfied. And it's true that Trump has made Japan nervous, made South Korea nervous, shown little leadership in dealing with certain other problems in the region. But I don't think that China and Russia are really in a position to take a lot of advantage of it because of their own problems.
Well, Gilbert Rosman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia, the editor of the ASEAN Forum. He's the author of International Relations in Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations, and North Korea and Mongolia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.